Thank you for downloading this podcast of Gene Williams talking about Olympian Pat Smythe at MMU's Institute for Performance Research Symposium on Sporting Lives, held on December the 4th of 2010.
Elements to the introduction. One is to say that equestrianism is an important post-war phenomenon. Secondly, to highlight the aspects of sport and resource, which is something that Pat Smythe particularly made me think about in reading her autobiographies. And thirdly, we know that given what's happened with the recent World Cup allocation, that sporting bodies are now absolutely obsessed by legacy. And to argue that Pat Smythe had an immediate legacy in British culture, and furthermore, she was known as, and I think is still known as, Britain's greatest and best-loved horsewoman. In doing this, I've looked at the autobiographies, and you'll probably be familiar that she wrote her first autobiography in 1954, and her last, Leaping Life's Fences, in 1992. So I'm looking at sport as leisure, work, writing, personal brand and cultural practice, and then offering some concluding thoughts. So equestrian sport is one which involves the relationship between athlete and animal in individual and team dynamics. Princess Anne, as the lone Olympic competitor of the present royal family today, perhaps draws our attention to this fashionable upper class pursuit, yet there are many women who have been part of this tradition. The issue over the injury to Toy Town, owned by Zara Phillips, and her possible exclusion from the Olympic competition as a result, raises perhaps facetious questions over whether the rider should be given the medal or the horse. The militaristic nature of equestrian sport before 45 has been well documented. In the Second Boer War, the British forces alone lost over 300,000 horses, whilst over World War I, Britain lost almost 500,000 horses, a subject that's led to the recent Spielberg adaptation of Michael Mapurgo's War Horse, a novel for children written in 1982 that has recently been an incredible success as a play at the National Theatre. Yet surprisingly, very little research exists on equestrian sports beyond interest in the sport of horse racing. In the 1900 Olympic Games, Elvira Guerra competed for France on Libertine in the Hacks and Hunter combined competition, but some dispute whether this was an Olympic event. And again, a relatively unknown figure in British sports history, Helen Preece, similarly tried to compete in the 1912 modern pentathlon competition, but was declined the opportunity by the governing body. So while equestrianism was to have an important place in Olympic competition, Pat Smythe and other female riders were to popularise it in Britain after 1948 as a wider cultural practice. And I guess something that most people around the room will be familiar with is Norman Thelwell's work of cartoons, the unofficial artist of the British countryside and one of Britain's most popular cartoonists. Thelwell's first pony cartoon was published in Punch in 1953, and he died early in 2004 at the age of 80. But he was not the first or only cartoonist of what came to be known as the Thelwell pony. And these are examples of Giles, depictions of Pat Smythe. There is a recognisable cultural type, which we can see in his first book, a collection of cartoons entitled Angels on Horseback, which was inspired by his observations of two hairy ponies, small and round and fat, and of a very uncertain temper, who grazed in a field next to his house. And this is where I declare my personal interest in the subject. I owned such a horse. He may look like a glorified donkey to you, but he meant the world to me. And that's my sister on the Bay Hunter she was given on her 18th birthday. You can see that she was a very much more glamorous figure than I was. Motor racing and equestrianism focus our attention on the disparity of resources in sport, both in terms of access to the best machine or livestock, but also, for the purposes of this paper, the gendered nature of access. Pat Smythe's career as an Olympian began later than that of her horses. The conclusion of this paper then returns to the question of resources as a much bigger topic and asks where sport sits in relation to them in the 21st century. In 1956, Smythe and Bridget Stockhart of Belgium were to be present at the Stockholm Olympic Games, and Smythe helped Britain to win a team bronze. She had already been made an OBE the same year and was a published author. Like Mary Rand in the 60s, Smythe was conflicted by media interest in her private life, but she was also one of several post-war British sports personalities to have a high-profile career as a writer and columnist. Being an Olympian was practically a footnote in Smythe's personal journey. Though women had competed in the dressage since 1952, this show jumping first nevertheless marked a change in the militaristic nature of Olympic equestrian competition, and more people from a wider range of backgrounds began to take part in more equestrian events in Britain and abroad. So I'm going to try and skip through the early life as briefly as I can. Pat Rosemary Smythe was born on the 22nd of November 1928 at 24 Shotfield Avenue, East Sheen, to join elder brother Ronald, already 3 and a half, and in her words, as a replacement for elder brother Dickie, who died of a heart complaint 2 years and a day before. Her father noted in his diary, "Patricia born, 10:05 a.m. Monique, splendid. Dull, wet morning. To office after lunch. Aunt Isabel died today." Monique, her mother, had been brought up with three brothers at Cromhall Rectory in Gloucestershire, riding farmers' hunters and point-to-pointers. At St Swithin's School, Winchester, she was captain of the cricket 11 and head of house, so this seems to be where Pat's love of sport came from. Monique was married at 19 to Eric Smythe. The second son of an electrical engineer, Eric and his brother Gordon were taken to Davos, where their father when their father contracted tuberculosis. This meant that both sons became fluent in German, French and English, going to school in Lausanne. Eric then went to Heidelberg University and qualified as a civil engineer working in the military before becoming the youngest staff officer in the intelligence corps. So it seems to have been a precarious kind of upper middle class upbringing, as the family briefly owned a £2,000 horse called Beaufort by Barnes Common. Pat therefore grew up close to the Roehampton Club with its roller skating rink, swimming pool, golf course, tennis and polo matches, but also within reach of plenty of open space. Monique Smythe was often sent horses to break in and school, and Pixie was such a pony, having been kicked and blinded in one eye. With 13 as her lucky number, Pat won equal first prize on Pixie at the Richmond Horse Show in 1939 and came to national prominence. And this is one example where history couldn't be improved upon by fiction. She came equal first with a guy called Dougie Bunn and Fred Winter. There were to be difficult years, however. Eric Smythe's rheumatoid arthritis meant his health was fragile, and he was advised to go for dry cure in Africa, effectively leaving the family homeless, and Pat was sent to boarding school. It was to persuade her never to send her own children to board. And a large part of the Smythe mythology now developed in these war years, born out of the combination of an innate ability to bring on horses, especially those considered frail or flaky, an entrepreneurial can-do spirit, and a matriarchal family structure. A lot of this was born of necessity. Eric was to die 19th of January 1945, having tried a range of therapies from gold injections to psychic healing. It helped, of course, to have family friends such as the Drummond Hay family, daughters of the Duchess of Hamilton, who invited the Smythes to their Fernie Gymkhanas, society and sporting events which were photographed for Tatler. But Pat Smythe, though an Olympic class name dropper, was not a total snob. She had much to say in praise of circus families and their empathy with animals in using the psychology of each character as part of their training, for example. In the holidays, both the children and the ponies worked on local farms, and the ethic of hard graft in the face of adversity also became a Smythe trademark. Mizzenden House, for example, looks like a country pile, but it was paid for by a combination of teaching children to ride and speak English, as well as being a guest house and a term time lodging for students at Cirencester College of Agriculture. It was launched as such on Pat's 21st birthday. And the unschooled horse finality, I just want to pick out one example of a horse to show how bringing on horses actually caused competitive difficulties for Pat, but was also part of the entrepreneurial aspect of what she could do. Finality was to be an important purchase, bought for £40 each with Johnny Trail, the polo and golf pro. Finality was the product of a thoroughbred stallion and a milk cart pony who'd been honourably retired to stud for kicking the cart to pieces in Tunbridge Wells High Street. It seemed initially that Finality had inherited her mother's sense of humour. Smythe and Finality won the horse jumping event at the White City in 1948, women not being allowed to take part in the Olympic Games. Financially as well as in terms of prestige, entering a horse show for shillings and winning pounds became an important means of supplementing, then forming the family income. It also meant a life of travel, as Smythe was selected for the British team travelling to Belgium in 1948, and this was no mean feat given the number of army riders and horses in post-war competition. It also meant that Trail wanted to sell the horse for £1,500 four years after it was purchased, and Finality was sold by the time of the post-Olympic competition, which is in the bottom photograph there, the George VI Cup. And the next year, Pat Smythe went on to win this cup. The next year, a Princess Elizabeth Cup for ladies was introduced to save male egos. I'll go through this quite quickly, just to show that there was incredibly serious injury. It is a very kind of dicey sport, and this is at the time of this accident, which actually injured the horse badly and hospitalised Pat Smythe. This was the second time that she'd been over this jump. She managed to clear it on the first horse, but the second horse didn't make it over. So you find a series of patterns where her health was actually injured by this sport, and she had early hip operations. The first Horse of the Year show in 1949 was therefore another nationally important breakthrough event for Smythe, overseen by Colonel Mike Ansell, who used the White City to provide an indoor show. On a loaned Finality, Smythe won the leading show jumper of the year. She then won the French Ladies' Cup on Novice Leona and the Belgian Grand Prix on another loaned horse called Nobler. This so surprised the International Equestrian Federation that they did not have rules in place to prevent a woman from winning. Smythe's reputation in Europe helped her domestic fame in Britain, and this developed in 1950 when she bought a bay for £150 at the National Hunt Meeting and retitled him Prince Hal. She paid a similar price for Tosca. The television public were again entertained by the Horse of the Year show in 1950, with Smythe on Finality tying equal first with Llewellyn and Fox Hunter. And one of the reasons for showing you that early photograph of me and my sister is Finality was about 15-2. Llewellyn on Fox Hunter was nearly 20 hands high. So it was a real height difference between the two horses. However, 53 was to be a grim year. Monique Smythe was killed in a road accident in January. The bank manager phoned on the same afternoon to ask for the repayment of £1,500 on the house, and Leona was sold immediately to raise the funds. Later that year, the 7-foot-high banker at the Nice show would injure Pat, Tosca and Prince Hal. All three were to recover, and the year seemed to improve when Roy Plumley invited Pat onto Desert Island Discs. Tosca in particular won £1,542 in 1952 and £1,350 in 1953 before a tour of America supplemented this income. So this is all before she competes in the Olympic Games as a supposed amateur. I'm not going to say too much about the Olympic Games because, as I've already indicated, she won a team bronze. And nevertheless, this is what she thought of competing in the Olympics. Germany won gold place, Italy in silver. Again, followed by a difficult period. Prince Hal was to die suddenly, a fact announced on the late BBC News. Such was his fame by then. And from this period on, Smythe spent more time travelling than at home. At the 1960 Rome event, the British team was disqualified by 8 a.m. due to David Barker's horse, Franco, refusing three times. And Smythe was nevertheless required to jump around with Flanagan in Rome to entertain the public. It was a dispiriting end to Olympic competition. Afterwards, though, she already had 11 books on the market by 1961 and two more to be published. Smythe could afford to buy Sudgrove in the Cotswolds with 150 acres and a pig farm. It also became clear that in spite of avoiding relationships with male equestrian colleagues, she'd fallen for the then-married Sam Coachlin, father of three small children. They married in September 1963, had two daughters, Monica and Lucy, and spent their time between Switzerland and Sudgrove. And this was hardly a retirement to the domestic sphere, though. And you can see in that central photograph, that's the author Laurie Lee. So she definitely used her sporting fame to become a celebrity more generally. The people that she hung out with and the kind of name dropping that she does in the books makes Rixie Marcus, if you've seen the work that I've done on Rixie Marcus, makes Rixie Marcus look shy and retiring. One of the things that I want to focus on then in beginning to draw this to some kind of a conclusion is to argue then that she then moves into a whole new career, and that whole new career post 1961 is into conservation. The International Union for Conservation and of Nature and Natural Resources had been formed in 1948 when Sir Julian Huxley was director of UNESCO, and Huxley had published a series of alarmist articles in The Observer in 1960 warning that the unique wildlife of East Africa would be extinct in 20 years, and campaigns seemed specifically to focus on rescuing tigers. Prince Bernard of the Netherlands became the first president of the World Wildlife Fund, formed in 1961. The Duke of Edinburgh was also a strong supporter and became president 20 years later. So joining this campaign, World Wildlife Fund, in 1961, Pat Smythe also saw that there are things that are more important than sport. She used her international fame to draw attention to the need for conservation of animals and natural resources. This green agenda has become a belated aspect of Olympic competition, but there is a fundamental paradox here. As many commentators have pointed out, there is a flaw in hosting a mega event designed to draw large numbers of international tourists to a particular host country using huge amounts of natural resource in order to stage something as unimportant as a nationalistic sporting contest. Having spent from 1948 until 1963 in top-level sport, Pat Smythe was to dedicate the rest of her life to conservation projects until her death in 1996. And we could argue that over the same period in Olympic history, the global market forces of commercial sport have predominated over the ethical concerns of our planet. Have green games become part of a corporate social responsibility agenda designed to shield the Olympics from the worst criticisms that environmental protesters might level at the degree of expense, waste and consumption? In conclusion today, my claims for Pat Smythe as the great Olympian are threefold, and I'm just going to run through this quickly. As I've said, she was an incredibly successful entrepreneur, and there's a list of the books. She not only wrote autobiographies, books on horses, books on travel and books on conservation, but she had her own children's book series. And one of the things I just wanted to draw attention to is how she incorporated travel, going on holiday over the border and to Rome as part of her as part of her writing for children. The other thing I want to query is the thing raised by Jennifer Hargreaves in 1984. I became conscious of this slight academic sneer, talking about women who had been seduced by the games. And I think it's rather patronising of academics to think that women who compete in the games have somehow been seduced by them. I think that there's much more interesting elements of the Pat Smythe story than that. And I'd also draw attention to the importance of equestrian sport in Britain today. It's often overlooked. We kind of very often talk about football, rugby and cricket, but there are some 2.4 million horse riders in Great Britain, a lot of whom are aged 5 to 15 years. There's a lot of money spent on keeping horses, but also Riding for the Disabled is one of the most popular UK charities, and the rise of interest among different disability groups, like for example the use of riding amongst students with autism, is again something that could be explored more fully. And so, in conclusion, while male riders such as Harvey Smith and a number of others that we could mention felt no compunction in the years after Pat Smyth to behave properly, equestrian women were aspirational figures. And I've mentioned Lucinda Green, Virginia Leng, Dawn Palethorpe. Might Smythe's pioneering conservation work be viewed, like that of yachtswoman Ellen MacArthur more recently, as drawing attention to issues which transcend sport? As compassionate and engaged environmental ambassadors, long before slogans about the greenest games ever became commonplace, Smythe and her co-equestrians deserve more recognition. Thank you.
Thank you, Jane.